Audio for the Retro Computing Roundtable is hosted by CyberEars. When you need a rock-solid platform to host and distribute your podcast or other audio media, head over to CyberEars.com. Fast, reliable hosting with unlimited bandwidth. CyberEars is your audio on your terms.
It's January 31st, 2016, and welcome to episode 119 of the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Well, it seems the Emerald City is far behind me now, and my world has changed back from black to white. But no matter where I go, there's just one thing I like to know.
RCR is a podcast about retro computer news, nostalgia, collecting, and just keeping up with all of the inflow of information. So, good day. Welcome to the end of January. Today we have, once again, Carrington Vanston from Toronto. How are you, Carrington?
Once again is better than for the last time, because I'd be worried you knew something. I am excellent. I am roughly awesome.
Excellent. That is how we characterized this show as we were sort of planning it. I thought it would be rough. But it was clearly going to be roughly awesome.
Approximately acceptable.
Yes. Also joining us from Sweden is Jack Nutting. How are you, Jack?
I am nominally okay.
Excellent. All right. all systems on.
All systems maybe.
Right.
So we're episode 119, and I just looked it up. 119 is the sum of five consecutive prime numbers. 17 plus 19 plus 23 plus 29 plus 31.
Perfect. Excellent. And 31 is the last of those numbers, and 31 is the day. So,
amazing.
There. I'm sure there's some sign in that. But okay. So, I am the host today, and so I was scrambling to try to figure out what to put in the show notes, as I was more disorganized this time than usual, and it struck me that, well, I mean, so one thing is the retro computing hobby seems to be gaining traction. My feeling is that more people are getting interested in it than were before. And it probably has something to do with people reaching certain ages and so forth. But there's a lot of activity, a lot of people making new cards and scanning things and documenting things and making new software. And it's starting to seem like there's just too much to actually digest at once. So that's and, you know, particularly in a short time when you're trying to prepare an episode. So I was trying to think about how one might manage these things and thought perhaps maybe we could throw that out to everybody. How do you manage the fact that the information load is increasing? Do you just put the rest of your life aside and focus on this? Are there certain things you focus on? Are there certain favorite news sites that condense things for you? How do you keep up? Even before answering that, I will throw that around the table. So, Jack, what's your thought on that?
Well, I think, like you said, this is definitely happening, and there's a lot more information coming out about all kinds of things. I think my solution to this is kind of my solution to all kinds of things on the internet in general, is to find places where the information is curated in some sense, even if it's in a very loose sense. Sources that may be sort of overwhelmed with stuff tend to be things that I would not look at as much anymore, and instead would rely on more limited selection of things through some sort of filter. So, for instance, like the various Facebook groups for retro computing and that sort of thing, I'm more likely to notice when something's posted there anyway than to notice when something that appears on a website that I may or may not go and visit. And the things that people take the time to post on a lot of the Facebook groups are often things that, you know, someone has noticed it already and sort of pre-viewed it and thought about it and said, hey, this is worth looking at, and someone else can share that. So that, I think that's where sort of a lot of my stuff comes from nowadays, is either from that or from listener feedback on this show, obviously. We get a lot of that. So in a way, I don't see it as that much of a problem, I guess, because I'm not typically perusing a whole lot of retro sites all the time. And again, and the reason I'm not is because I feel like that sort of need is kind of disappearing for me because things are popping up in Twitter and Facebook and stuff. It's, for me, it's similar to, like, again, almost anything like politics or computing news in general or programming news in general. I see things appear in my feeds that are sort of like, I've picked people that I'm following, and I can, if I kind of follow their lead, I will tend to find usually the good stuff, it seems to me.
The good stuff.
Yep. Yeah. Carrington, what's your take on that?
I'm not totally sure that there is an increase in information. It feels that way. So that's, I feel the exact same, but I can't know if that's the case or if it's just that it's increasingly easy to get the information. Like, Twitter brings so much to me, and you find Reddit groups, and there's so many places that aggregate information, and increasingly they subdivide themselves into very narrow focus. And so I'll say, hey, I'm interested in old computers, and I'm interested in old video games. I'm basically interested in old stuff. And so there will be old stuff of this technology, or of this category, and old stuff of this category. And so other people, just like Jack was saying, are curating it, finding the best stuff, and throwing it at me on Facebook, on Twitter, in Reddit. And so I get more and more information because of that. I don't know that there is more out there, but certainly it does seem more software and devices are being made than it used to be the case. But there's more info that I have access to. How I deal with that is basically, to be honest, by not dealing with it. I don't let it overwhelm me, and I don't care if I miss stuff. Now, maybe that makes me more zen than I would apparently, I would come across as. But I have a few times in my life reached inbox zero, like that idea that you'll have nothing in your email inbox. But the way I have done it is different than the way other people do it. I don't finally get a system and start replying to everything in a timely manner. What I do is it gets so overwhelmingly behind the scenes, I just select everything, hit delete, declare email bankruptcy, inbox zero. It's awesome. And so I find that I do that maybe once or twice a year, and that's the only way I keep up. I keep up with news for hobby things anyway, pretty much the same way. I'll get to a point that I'm too far behind on Twitter, so I just say, well, I'll start reading from this point. If it's that important, it will bubble back up. So I don't worry about missing it. I simply remind myself that a hobby is something I'm supposed to enjoy, and I will just, you know, take a break from Facebook, come back, not worry about what I missed, and figure I can pick it up as I go. So that's the way I deal with it, is essentially by not dealing with it.
Yeah. Yeah, that was, as I was thinking about this too, that one of the concerns, the only reason this sort of matters is that you might miss something, that there are so many things going by. But yeah, I guess you can, to the extent that people do repost the things that they found interesting on either with some frequency in Twitter or on Facebook, even, you know, I'm finding actually with Facebook, this, it's good, and all this stuff goes in sort of cycles, but the feed in the one that I'm in most often, the Apple II enthusiasts group, just flies by. I mean, like, if you leave it for 2 days, you know, it's, many of the things are pages and pages and pages down. So unless, you know, there's new comments on it that bubble it back up to the top. And so I wonder what things I'm not seeing, even though, you know,
all the best stuff. It was amazing. We couldn't believe you missed it.
Yeah, exactly. But, it, I mean, yeah, so it's, what I tend to do is basically, you know, I sort of pay attention when there's time, and I just miss stuff. I mean, I know I'm missing stuff. Sometimes, occasionally I will, like at the beginning of the day or something, flip back through the Twitter feed, and I will find things that are interesting, and I will try to make a note of them, or I will remember 2 weeks later that I saw that in the past and wanted to look at it.
But if you do that, then you're just reinforcing the idea that interesting stuff is happening and you're missing it.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's a dangerous thing to do. I'd rather just not know and just imagine. Coincidentally, whenever I look at Twitter is when all the best stuff happens.
Right, right.
Yeah, it's the kind of thing where if you don't have time to notice everything going on, then when you later on look at things, like, you're already looking at the better stuff. Like you said, the stuff that wasn't, turned out to not be that useful or interesting, doesn't bubble up again. Things that are interesting tend to continue and get a life of their own. You will see it again if it's something that is actually interesting to a lot of other people. So it's the kind of thing, yeah, where you could like leave the retro computing community entirely for a year and come back, and like, you wouldn't have to catch up on everything that happened during the year. You could just look around and say, oh, what's, you know, what are people doing now? What's the, you know, what are the latest things now? And stuff that you missed is probably, you know, it's either going to be mentioned or it's maybe wasn't that interesting to begin with.
I do sometimes miss things and I am not able to catch up. There is every once in a while some sort of scandal or some sort of something going on in one of the retro computing communities, like all the Apple II people will be up in arms about something. And I will read some of the comments and from context, I can't really figure out what happened and who's upset about what and for what reason. And then I think maybe it doesn't matter that I don't know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I don't know. Anyway,
eventually we'll retire and we'll have more time and I can just spend 24 hours a day on the Apple II.
Oh yeah. No, it's definitely what I think about when I'm, you know, looking around this room full of junk that I have. I mean, it's like all of these are retirement projects and these are retirement projects for about like 7 lifetimes.
It occurred to me quite a while ago that a whole bunch of really good, really interesting and creative programmers are eventually going to have a bunch of time on their hands and not really a need to get paid for it. And some fascinating, weird, quirky software is probably going to come out in 20 years.
Excellent. And we'll cover it here.
Yes. On the Retro Computing Roundtable.
Yes, we will. That may be the reason why so many, I don't know, I've never correlated against age. Is it the case that lately there's been so much new software and new hardware out there simply because people are retiring and have time to say, yeah, I'm going to spend 6 months on making this board?
Yeah, could be. Hmm. Although some of the people that I see producing, you know, many, many things somehow are also managing to sort of like have real jobs and work and stuff. So
screw those people.
Yeah, I don't know how they do it. it's sort of like, it's a little bit frustrating because I see it and I think, oh, I want to do that. I have all these other things that I actually have to do. One needs to be able to, you know, maintain the employment up until the retirement age. So anyway, yeah. So, I mean, I guess one thing what you out there in the listener world are doing is listening to us try to condense the things for you.
That's how you keep up with it.
Yeah.
The RCR.
I listen to next week's RCR and then it's much easier. But anyway, yeah, if people have ideas out there, I mean, this is probably an insoluble problem or isn't a problem, one of the two, but we'll be interested to hear your thoughts. So, okay, so let's see. We had some listener feedback, and I'm not going to go through all of it, but a couple of things that caught my eye as I was looking at it. The Boston Computer Society was I don't think it still exists, but it, you know, it was sort of a big computer group, you know, enthusiasts group back in the early days of the mid 70s and 80s, and some videos have been recently released by the Computer History Museum. I think there was a previous video or maybe a previous couple of videos that showed Steve Jobs introducing the Mac. This was one of the earliest. It was kind of like a rerun of the shareholders meeting or whatever it was originally demoed at. But there are now I think 5 new videos of meetings and presentations at meetings for various things. So one is Avram Miller introducing the DEC personal computers. There's Chuck Peddle and the Victor 9000. Some interesting stuff here, which I have not seen, but I'm looking forward to looking at it. Have either of you either seen these or seen the previous BCS video?
Not at all. Like you said, the thing with Steve Jobs demoing some tech there is pretty legendary, but I have not seen it. I've heard about the Boston Computer Club, but I've not really seen anything from it at all.
I am, alas, in the same boat.
Mm-hmm. You'd think I would know something about that since it's more or less local, but
we expected you to shoulder that one. You let everybody down, Paul.
I think I have somewhere along the line. I think I got an old I don't know what it is, like a member directory or something from, you know, the 90s or something. So, you know, sometime in the not entirely distant but fairly distant past.
So the BCS may have existed up until and after the time you moved to Boston.
It is conceivable. It might even exist now. I really don't know.
They may be listening right now.
They say at the bottom of this article, the BCS, active in the 1980s and 1990s, was the world's largest personal computer user organization. Mm-hmm. So that suggests that it's no longer around.
Right.
No, it just means it's no longer the largest. It may now be the second largest one, and yet none of us have heard of it.
It may be the smallest. It may just be one guy now.
Yep.
It may just be Paul.
Oh, no. I'm way behind on my membership.
The first rule of BCS.
That's why we had that topic. Yes, Paul just can't keep up with it. Turns out he's president of the BCS.
Let's see. Did I say? That was listener feedback from Paul. So thanks. I think I didn't actually cite the source. And Tony sent a link to a trailer for a movie called Memoirs of a Spectrum Addict.
I'm fascinated about this.
This looks really cool to me. Yeah. Again, I haven't fully watched it, but the trailer exists, and it's setting up like a documentary film that is going to be sort of a tribute to the Sinclair ZX Spectrum, and it appears to be. So Carrington, actually, maybe you read this more closely than I did. It looks like it's basically they were having modern children actors kind of acting out the what it was like to be introduced to the Spectrum and grow up with it.
That's what it seems to be. Yes. So there'll be some. It's a documentary, but it looks like there's going to be a bunch of reenacting it. I think it looks really fascinating. I mean, hooray for the Spectrum. Cool computer I have very little experience with, but would like more. And I just think the whole thing looks neat. So I say bring it on.
It looks like it is an independent film project for sure. I mean, like, I think, in fact, it's relatively, what do you call it? Not novice, but amateur, right? I mean, like, it may well be done very well. I mean, suggesting that it might not be a good project, but it looks like it's basically sort of like a school project that they're trying to put it together, which also seems pretty neat. The cream of the acting talent from Branston Community Academy.
Yes, which are 13 and 10 year olds.
Right. So anyway, I'm definitely going to keep an eye on that, and we'll have a link in the show notes to the trailer. Okay. Anyway, that's cool. We'll leave the listener feedback at that, and some of the things we'll get to below. I think we got links to as well, but below I am gesturing down the show notes. But
look down there.
Right. But so now we can move on to the actual items of interest in news, not well differentiated from the feedback. But Carrington, you have the first one.
I do indeed, and so this really caught my eye. Speaking of news to keep up with, John Calhoun, name people might know if you were a fan of classic Mac shareware back in the day, particularly the game Glider. That's where I knew him from. He has released the source code to those classic games. So Glider, which I think was the fourth version. So yeah, Glider 4 and Glider Pro. He also did Pararena and Glyfa, which I remember that shooter game. Those have all now been released, so the source code. So if you're interested in either just viewing how these things were done or developing for classic Mac OS or just, you know, reliving the fun that was Glider, one of the all-time great games, you can check out the source code. So I'm super excited about it. I have grabbed copies of everything, but I haven't actually looked at it yet. But I'm really looking forward to it because I was a big, big fan of Glider and a big, big fan of that era of gaming, like the old 512 pixel black and white screen Toaster Mac era of gaming. And so hooray for this. I'm really looking forward to going through this.
That's really cool. Yeah. Do we know what it's the development environment is?
I know nothing.
Hooray.
I can't keep up with that information.
Yeah, I would be curious to see this. Took the like very smallest little forays into classic Mac programming, you know, back when it was not classic, but just Mac. And I wrote a little. I was kind of pleased with it. I wrote a Tetris game because everybody writes a Tetris game. But I called it Triste, and a sad Tetris game. And what was sort of interesting about this? I think this actually might be like Martin's game. What is that called?
Structress.
Yeah.
Love Structress.
But so what mine did is instead, like the piece falls down the middle. Otherwise it's straight Tetris. But the piece falls down the middle and you move the playfield. And sometimes the playfield is bit wider than your window. So right. I don't know. It was a fun exercise to write the thing, and it would be interesting to see what professional people actually did.
Yeah. So his stuff was published by Cassidy and Green back in the day, except maybe not Glyfa. Which I think I referred to as a shooter, but it's not a shooter. It's a classic arcade game, but it's Joust. So a version of Joust. But Glider was like one of the games for me. I loved Glider. It's available on iOS now. Not as good on iOS as it was back in the day, I think. I just loved it. So that's the one I'm definitely going to check out, is how was Glider done?
Cool. Yeah, I think I might have played that a couple times. Jack, did you ever do any of these?
I remember playing Glider, and I was going to say it was either on your Mac, Paul, or if not yours, which apparently not, it must have been on Lauren Wu's. But like, because I never had a Mac back in those days. But I remember playing it, and it was like, yeah, this is kind of a neat game. It was not like graphically amazing or anything, but there was a nice sort of feel to it, and the graphics were fun. There was like this interesting sort of, you know, flying through a house and stuff. It was cool.
Mm-hmm. Yep. There was another game that, you know, another sort of like black and white classic Mac game that the source code was released for not so long ago. The game itself was basically you fly around a maze where, and, you know, you have little guns shooting at you and things like that. But
Continuum?
Continuum, yes. Oh, because that was such a hard game. I used to play that all the time. I would always run into the walls.
Yep, I loved Continuum. Yeah, good. I didn't know that was released or the source code was out. So that's one I'd want to check out too. I really liked Continuum.
Yeah, I think I'm not wrong about that, but...
No, you're not wrong.
Hooray!
We believe in you.
But anyway, I at the very least, you can get it still. There's some relatively... you know, recent posting about it by the author, one of the authors, I think, of Continuum. I will find that perhaps before we're done recording. Okay, Jack, you have an interesting thing about the 6502.
Yeah, so there is an assembler called Macross, not to be confused with the early 80s anime series of the same name and spelling, but it's an assembler. It's basically a macro assembler created at LucasArts when they were working on their 8-bit software for 6502. And the story is, apparently they had an earlier assembler that was actually done in Lisp. You would write your assembly code in Lisp, and the problem was it would take many, many, many minutes, like 45 minutes, to compile down a 16K ROM. So it's not that useful.
Oh my goodness.
So somebody was tasked early on with making a new assembler with macro capabilities of sorts that would be more like a traditional assembler in terms of how it ran and how it worked and how it looked. And Macross is what they created. So apparently this was used for all of the 6502-based games that Lucasfilm did in the mid-80s for the Ataris and Commodore 64. The original article here mentions that it was used for Habitat and Club Caribe and various things. But then someone replied, said, actually, no, it wasn't just used for that. This is actually used from the beginning for everything we did on the 6502. So it's pretty neat. It actually lets you, I haven't tried this out yet, but they have taken the code, modernized it. It compiles and runs on Mac OS X and probably other Unixes. And it's nice because it lets you skip a lot of the, like, 6502 branch instructions and labels, and instead you can do things in a structured way, similar to C or any other structured language. And it has a macro language, so you can make sort of function-like things that are actually laid out as just assembly code when you're done. So pretty cool, and apparently you can do some things with this today. You can just fire it up and build some stuff and run things in emulators and whatever you want. I don't know if like the tooling is there for immediately creating all kinds of binaries for all kinds of 6502 machines, but maybe. I don't know. It looks very interesting anyway. I think it looks like a much more approachable way to deal with assembly if you're starting a product from scratch, because you can do things in a little bit more structured way. So worth checking out.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to play with that. I'll definitely have to take a look at it. And actually, the stuff that... I don't know if pagetable.com is a single person or a group or something, but the stuff posted on that site is overall great. So this is a good article, but also check the other things that are on this as well.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen this site before. There seems to be a lot of interesting stuff here.
Excellent. Okay, I'm next, apparently. There's a show, it's primarily, I think, I don't know if it's audio or video or both. I mean, there is a video portion to it. Maybe people think of it as a video show, hosted by Leo Laporte and Mike Elgin, called Triangulation. And the January 25th episode of this, number 235, has an interview with Bill Fernandez, who is Apple employee number 4. So that's interesting to listen to, just hear about the stories of old. And soon after we're done recording this, I will go listen to it myself. So I don't know what's in there, but I think it's neat to have a chance to have this interview. Also, the cover page, the cover photo is the old Jobs house that has the garage that they didn't actually assemble things in.
Which is not always the way it's described.
Yeah, right. Exactly. But I forget exactly when that, you know, there was some interview of Steve Wozniak, I think not too long ago, where he was kind of saying, oh, it's, you know, that was, it was kind of a nice story, but really mostly we did it somewhere else and brought it in there, you know, to store it or whatever. But so anyway, it's worth taking a listen to, and I can't give you more of an endorsement than that until I listen to it myself. But Leo Laporte does a pretty good job of hosting.
Yeah.
So yeah, it'll probably go pretty well. Carrington, back to you.
Back to me. I got nothing. So actually, I've got old school PC fonts. I like fonts. I love font packs, and I like in particular fonts that look like old things because it's really fun to use them. In terminals, it's also just fun to just use them for backgrounds. Sometimes it's fun to use them when you're just mocking up a pretend image from the past and you want a higher resolution. So Apple II fonts are out there and Commodore fonts and lots of things, but I hadn't encountered a really good classic PC font repository. And then it turns out there's a great one. So the old school PC font resource, it's called, and we'll have a link in the show notes. And so you can grab from there in various formats. So they come in text, whatever, and other whatevers. So for whichever computer you want to put them on, there's the PC BIOS font. There's AT&T, the 6300 font. If you want the font that looks like the Tandy 1000, they've got it for you. So old school PC fonts, super awesome, really nice site. Download everything. It's free. And as far as I can tell, it's a free do whatever you want with it resource as well. But check the license just in case I'm wrong about that. But if you're looking for good fonts and you're looking for particularly vintage PC fonts from the pre-Windows days, then this is the site for you.
It doesn't seem like the kind of thing I would think, oh, yeah, that's cool. But just looking at the page, look at the page. Even if you don't think this sounds cool,
yeah,
it is cool. Look at the page.
Yeah.
Because there's something that's just sort of like, it just strikes me, seeing, I guess particularly, what this is probably the PC BIOS font, but, you know, I know I can see this on an emulator or whatever, but somehow I really like looking at it.
And the page mm-hmm. itself is nice because it lets you switch between different fonts on the page. So you can view the web page itself in different PC fonts. In the upper right corner is a control for it, which
nice.
Is pretty nice.
Yep.
A nice touch.
It's a really nice implementation. So it's just you browsing the site itself, you feel like you've just logged into a BBS yeah. to get this stuff. It's just an incredibly fast BBS
yeah.
with very large fonts. But I just really, really liked it. So I thought it was well put together, great looking fonts. I downloaded everything just in case. I'd rather have it and not need it. I'm quite chuffed about it.
Yeah, I'm quite pleased. I think, you know, honestly, I think that the thing that grabbed me the most at first, and I don't know quite why, is this user interface, you know, I don't know, what mechanic or whatever, that puts little square brackets around the items. You know,
yeah.
So at the top there is little links, and they're all in these little square brackets. It just looks so BBS-y.
Yep.
Okay.
But if you've been pining for, like, I want the font that I used to have on my Phoenix graphics card, mm-hmm. then they've got it for you.
Right. And you might not have known that you were pining for it.
Right.
So go look at the site, and you were. okay, so continuing the recent tradition of announcing on each episode the people who have passed away, Marvin Minsky, the you know, famous pioneer in artificial intelligence, has recently passed away. This the article in the New York Times that was talking about it is dated January 25th, so I guess that was a week ago as we're recording. According to the article, he was 88. So I have to admit, Marvin Minsky's name is one of the ones that I know, but I don't know his work exactly. I just know that he's, you know, sort of deep at the beginning of kind of work on artificial intelligence. So. But it's, you know, it's still sad to hear that you know, the first generation of people who are doing these things are leaving us.
I'm aware of him, and I was aware that he was an AI pioneer, and I was aware that one of his big things was that the brain is not really fundamentally different than a computer. Like he was of the school that said we just need a complex enough computer and there we can have actual AI, which is just I, not artificial. that was one of the big ideas, right? So I've read some of his stuff, but that's unfortunately all I know. I'm also a really bad person to have on a show where we talk about people die because I am so irreverent. I'm holding back just tons of really inappropriate comments. And it's just, it's who I am, unfortunately. So that's really all I should say.
Okay.
That's why we save all that inappropriate stuff for the outtakes, which we will never publish. Sounds... We'll publish when we die. Then all the terrible things we said can be exposed to the world.
Yes, exactly.
One of the gadgets that I invented, which was really perhaps the most stupid machine of all, was I described a little box with a switch on it. And when you flip the switch on, a hand comes out of the box and turns the switch off. So that was nice. And Claude had a machine shop, and he actually built one. And somehow this machine got a lot of publicity because it was, most people thought that was perhaps the most useless machine ever made so far.
One thing that is worth linking to is that masswork.at, a site that we've linked to for various things. I think there was a space war simulator, and there's all kinds of very interesting projects, sort of graphic projects that have been done by either the person or the people behind masswork.at. But there is something here now called the Minskytron. And I don't even entirely know what it is doing, but it is simulating a deck PDP-1. If we run tripause, this is something that Minsky actually wrote. But they all seem to be generally just oscilloscope screen, you know, vector screen designs. So you can read the description under the thing, and you will know more than I do right now.
Well, you can also, they actually run in the browser, so like it's a cool sort of animated, funky thing that apparently Minsky worked on these things. It's all there. I did see this a few days ago. There's like a description of the math behind it and how it's sort of like it calculates this sort of interesting circular patterns and stuff. So the
Minskytron is a visual synthesizer based on three interconnected oscillators. And then there's math.
Yes.
And then there's math. So I have a serious question. And honestly, I'm avoiding the whole brain in the jar stuff. But was he frozen? Or like his head or his whole body? Because reading up on him now, as we've been talking, looks like he was into cryonics. He was one of the signatories on the scientists' open letter on cryonics, saying it should be legal and it should be possible and we should promote that sort of thing. So did he get himself popsicleized or not?
that's the reverent term for this.
that's all you can ask from me. I'm doing pretty good. I'm wondering because I find that a really interesting thing, and it's not really retro computing oriented other than maybe you'd get really old popsicleizing or something, but just wondering because it doesn't say anything on the Wikipedia page about that, but he seemed to be keen on it, so I wonder if worked out for him. Yeah. He might be back and he might listen to this is what I'm saying.
Oh yes, well, welcome back.
Well, I just Googled Minsky popsicle, and I got nothing conclusive on this. So,
but they are available now. One day in the future, chronically frozen people will be a delicacy in Japan, and that's my last statement of that.
There's an official Alcor statement concerning Marvin Minsky, published just what is today? Just recently, just a couple days ago. Not sure who Alcor is. Alcor Life Extension Foundation.
Oh,
it says. In a public ceremony, therefore, if Alcor says that we can neither confirm nor deny that a specific person has cryonics arrangements with our organization, that could mean A, they don't have them, or B, that the individual has chosen to keep it private.
Well, I'm reading an official statement by Popsicle Brand, and they also are refusing to comment.
Right.
See, again, like I said, I'm the wrong person to have on this show.
Anyway, but yeah, it is, I mean, I guess... Part of the, you know, comment from the beginning about how people are reaching an age when they have time for this or they have nostalgia building for these, you know, old computer days. We also have this other end of the time elapsing.
We also all have a lot less time for this than we think. So go to Kansas Fest.
That's true. That's true. Even if it isn't the last Kansas Fest that happens, you never
know. I'm spreading the rumor that it is.
Oh, didn't we have a... Yeah, I guess, speaking of last fests, last Cocoa Fest, last Chicago Cocoa Fest, is...
The annual last Chicago Cocoa Fest, which I love.
Yeah, that the event is April 23rd and 24th. We got a flyer about that. It is the 25th annual last Chicago Cocoa Fest.
I owned a Cocoa. I still really like the Cocoa. I very much identify as an Apple II guy, but... Holy cow, do I want to go to Cocoa Fest. It's of all the non-Apple events, it's the one that draws me the most.
Well, there's a Commodore pet related thing near you, right? World of Commodore.
Yeah, sure, cuz the there's a big T-Pug. Pet users group in Toronto. T-Pug. Yeah, that I knew a guy who was big in T-Pug back in the day when it was a new computer. And it still exists and they still do it, and I don't go because that's not Apple, it's not Cocoa.
Right.
It's not even top four for me.
Right. But yeah, so this is in Chicago. The Cocoa Fest is in Chicago. It is April 23rd and 24th, and I'm not sure. Tickets are $10 for the first family member, and then it's half that for additional family members. So looks like it'll be a neat event. I think it's probably a little far for me to make it to it, but I do have a Cocoa I want to try making go. So once I do that, maybe I'll be even more inspired.
Looking at the list of things that may happen there, at the Floppy Days podcaster, he's not named, but that'd be Randy. He is a probably, so he will probably be there. Maybe I'll go and heckle. Hear that, Randy? I'm coming for you.
Well, it's not that far, is it, from you?
No, I have driven it many a time. I mean, it's a long day of drive. You can't go to Chicago and back from Toronto in the same day, really, but easily get there in a day. Long day, but you can do it. So it's a weekend trip, easy.
Excellent. Okay, so there goes your alibi.
Yep.
speaking in that same vein, the VCF East exhibitor registration has opened. That is, I guess, a week earlier, April 15th to 17th, 2016.
See, again, if I was retired, I could just tour these things, and that's what I would do for a living.
You would have an RV, and you would just cruise.
I would like to have an RV.
You would just cruise from Cocoa Fest to VCF or the way around.
Me and my big, shiny Airstream just cruise around. Sounds like an awesome life.
Yeah.
An RV full of old computers.
Exactly.
Well, yeah, I was going to bring that up. Somewhere I'll find a link at some point. Maybe I'll make a note to remind myself. But Peter at Kansas Fest one year had how to use your Apple IIc portably, because he was actually doing something like that, living in an RV for some extended period of time.
He was, yeah, in his sportsmobile. I followed it. I was always nudging him to do more posts. I found it all fascinating. He's a good guy. It was really interesting projects.
Yeah. And I think that there are posts that give specifications of these things, and I'm not sure if his talks are online. They might be. There might be videos of those, but
that would be an interesting topic. Maybe topic for a show, or maybe just people to write in on. If you are going to go live, you know, in a van down by the river or whatever, but you're going to go off grid, the Apple IIc, especially the original, not the Plus, but the Apple IIc, is one of those computers where there are a few different options to power it by just a 12-volt source. So you want to go live in the woods with solar panels, and you can relatively easily power if you want to go retro computing, an Apple IIc. I wonder what other computers are appropriate for full-time living in a cabin or an RV or something like that. What are your choices if you're going to become a hermit in the future, or a vagabond?
A ne'er-do-well.
Exactly. Well, those I think we have covered now. But
yeah, no, it would be interesting to hear what people's thoughts are on that. Okay, and I guess it is now time for a word from our sponsor. And we're back. So it is now time for the retro computing gift idea. And so I was looking around, actually a couple weeks ago, looking around for something to pick for this. And I came across, there was an eBay auction for one of these, but it turns out you can buy these beach balls that are, they're basically colored, they look exactly like the bouncing, you know, the, I don't know what you call it, the Boeing beach ball, or the Boeing ball in the Amiga demo. You know, that's, you know, blew everybody away when the Amiga came out. So, so I think someone who knows what it is, would appreciate this quite a lot. So there's a, I'm linking to a site that sells them. It's a little bit, I have to say that the site is not, you know, big corporation commerce site, but it does appear that you can buy them, and it looks like you can buy them for $450. That seems awfully cheap.
Yep.
But so not a big outlay for this, but I think it would be appreciated. And I think there are a couple of other sources of beach balls with this design. I mean, I think these aren't the only people who produce them, but. At any rate, it seemed like a neat thing.
Well, I noticed, but the website that this is on is, they sell a lot of like t-shirts and sweatshirts and baseball caps and stuff, and there's pictures of people wearing these things. And near the top of the site, there are links to a couple of YouTube videos that are said to be from 1998 and 99, which seem to have, some, at least I see one, the actress shown in one is also pictured in another photo. So I guess this is stuff that was created like 16, 17 years ago, this website for selling Amiga stuff. When it wasn't quite as far, like, didn't have so many nails in the coffin as it does now. And
it's just sort of like a hedgehog of nails at this point.
And so maybe they haven't updated these prices. Maybe that $450 is still the 1998 price, and that's why we get the good deal. I don't know.
I have to admit, I have not ordered one. I can't guarantee that it will appear, but it's a neat idea, at least. You can try this one, and if it doesn't work, you can find them out there as well.
When you go to the tracking site, it just shows you a picture of that ball spinning. Uh-oh.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Carrington, you found a cartoon this reminded you of.
I did indeed. The Perry Bible Fellowship. Very funny. Speaking of irreverent, very irreverent comics. But there's one of those. And so I won't ruin the punchline, but if you're... the whole idea of a spinning beach ball, it's well lampooned in the comic, and we'll have a link in the show notes.
Excellent. Thanks. Okay, so, you know, get your portable 2C and your beach ball and, you know, head off to the shore.
Exactly.
We can now go to check out eBay. What has happened on eBay? Yes, okay, Carrington, you have the first one here.
Well, I have a cover, so not a vintage item, but something to attach to a vintage item. And this is actually a product that Ivan Drucker and I were talking about, the idea of the product, at last year's Kansas Fest. We were discussing the Mystic upgrade. So a Macintosh Color Classic can be upgraded with a motherboard from another Mac, the LC575 motherboard, which is a more advanced one, will slide perfectly into a Color Classic. And the LC575 was codenamed the Mystic, so the Mystic upgrade for the Color Classic is to swap out the motherboard for a more capable one. There is one downside to that upgrade, though, is the ports don't match. So the cover on the back of the Color Classic has to just be left off, exposing the motherboard, because none of the ports line up. So we were talking about how, well, there's 3D printing. Why doesn't somebody just knock out a proper cover that will fit on a Color Classic, but have the knockouts for the Mystic Logic Board? Well, someone has, and it's not me, and it's not Ivan, so it's someone else, and they're selling them on eBay. Great idea. It's $15, and it is really just a 3D printed cover. The cover fits on a Color Classic, but the cutouts are for the Mystic Logic Board. So if you want to do that Logic Board upgrade, but you don't want a big hole in the back of your Color Classic, here's a great solution. Well, great in quotes. It's a very good solution, but alas, the color. The color has that pure white of 3D printing that just really isn't aesthetically appealing. And the reason to have this cover, which is on the back of your computer, is to complete the case. And so a lot of it is about aesthetics. So it's really disappointing that it's that color. But Charles Magnin to the rescue. So I tweeted about this to Ivan and was talking about how it's too bad about the color. And on Twitter, Charles Magnin stepped in, so I will talk to them about the appropriate paint. And so, of course, it could be colorized, and Charles would know. So maybe an even better version will come out in the future. But this one's $15, available now, and good solution if you want to do the Mystic upgrade.
Cool.
Yeah, and there do seem to be... I mean, it says 9 available, 34 sold, so plenty of them. have been made.
And also plenty of interest. I think a lot of people want to do that upgrade. Mm-hmm. And so, you've got the Color Classic. Why not, I guess, if you don't want to keep it legit. But yeah, so neat looking cover. I just don't like the color of it.
It's the upgrade. I mean, doing this upgrade, actually, I don't think it's actually very complex. I mean, it really...
No, it really is just a motherboard swap. There's a slightly more complex one you'd want to do, though. The Color Classic will actually support 640 by 480 video on the internal monitor. The monitor and the computer will support it. It just doesn't. That's a slightly more complicated upgrade, I think, with a bit of snipping and soldering. But you can upgrade the video a lot on the Color Classic if you're willing to chance that one. So that's a bigger upgrade. The motherboard swap literally is you just slide out and it slide another one. It's plug-in connectors and that's it.
Yeah, I have just a Color Classic and I took the motherboard out and it's just kind of stunning how it's just built to do that. I mean, maybe it's because they're expecting it to be, what do you call it, deployed in schools or something, and they just want to be able to like quickly repair things. But it's as if they want you to take it out.
Apple went through a few periods where at least some people in Apple thought computers should be upgradable by end users. And that seemed to always be something that some people in Apple were fighting other people in Apple about. So different designs would have different amounts of them that were user serviceable and user upgradable very easily. That whole war was lost by the upgrade camp. And modern Apple, it just doesn't even consider that anymore because it's got to be super thin.
Yeah. Yeah, they're always getting low, whatever it is, I fix it scores.
Yes. Nowadays, it's all just glued together and grown in a vat of goo or whatever.
I have one question about this, actually. It looks like just looking at the holes in the plastic, like there's one less hole. Mm-hmm. Is it just one less AppleTalk port, or what is the difference on those two boards?
Oh, I see. Yeah, there's a comparison picture that shows.
Oh, yeah. Okay, yes. There is. I think you still get the two ADB ports. No, you get one ADB port.
Oh, that's ADB.
But you still get the... Yeah, so you only get the one ADB port instead of two.
Got it.
And this also reminded me of... There's an episode... I think we must have linked to this maybe like two or three episodes ago of somebody, and I've forgotten his name, on the Computer Chronicles trying to demonstrate how the IBM PS2 is like easy to take apart and very modular and but doesn't actually manage to get it apart very easily. I will check the show notes from like three or four episodes ago, and I'll put a link in here as well to that if I remember.
I also realized that I was actually at the start of this, therefore, complaining that this was too white. It's like it hasn't yellowed enough. Boy, I complain. Some things are too yellowed. Some things are not yellowed enough. I seem to be very picky about my old Apple product colors.
I suppose you could print this in like red or something. Not even try. It almost seems worse.
Or de-retrobrite it. Right. It has to be retro dull.
I wonder if you can put it in the same like bath as something retro brighting, so all the yellow will like move over from the old computer to the new thing.
Could be.
Equalize them somehow. Oh, another thing I was going to mention. We're taking a long time on this one, but that I was going to mention was the seller, Polaroid Pict, is also the one who made the SE30 covers that we had on last time. So.
Oh, nice.
So.
I love those covers. I didn't end up picking one up, but I thought they were great looking.
Well, not too late. yeah. I think I've actually gotten at some point in the past a capacitor kit from the seller as well. So So things actually do get mailed from the seller. I can at least say that. okay, Jack, you have the next one.
Yes,
for the beach.
I've found something that will appeal to anyone who likes 80s. Horrible fashion, and who also likes Atari. This is the true vintage 1980s Atari puffer nylon vest. It's the classic sort of like puffy vest like Marty McFly is wearing all in the Back to the Future movies. Except it's not the orange, it's just blue, and it's got pockets, and it's got an Atari logo. And this could be yours for the buy it now price of $75.
Can't be mine. Doesn't ship to Canada.
Oh, man. Yeah.
Plus, it's been stained with an Atari logo.
I think that'll come out.
So, there you go.
This is super 80s. This is like
it's
ultimate
it's
80s.
In
all respects.
So 80s.
It's like so 80s that in the 80s I would have been ashamed to wear it.
And yet now I think I could rock this look.
I would love this.
I actually think it's pretty awesome.
I would love this thing. So there's the host gift idea. You really want this.
Let's see. Okay. So I have a couple, only a couple this time. So one that came up, and of course it was new when I put it in the show notes, and already it's gotten bid up pretty high, but it says Radio Shack 1980s Tandy 6000 hard drive microcomputer system. And this is something that you don't see very often. I think this is, if I'm understanding correctly what this is, it's kind of like a later iteration of what was the TRS-80 Model 2. So it was the business computer. This one has a hard drive in it, and it has a big floppy, which looks like it might actually be an 8-inch floppy drive there on the side of it. Looks like it's in pretty good condition. I'm not sure if it works.
It doesn't seem to. It seems to power on, but the video just gives scrolly bits.
Yeah.
Which is unfortunate.
Yeah.
Because it's a nice form factor.
Yeah, it's a weird alien. It looks a little, it looks like a TRS-80, kind of. But they are, as far as I understand, they are really quite hard to get now, anyway. And this is probably about as good as you can get in that line, if you can get it working again. So.
But the fact that it comes with a 15 meg hard drive, like, that's pretty cool.
Yeah.
Also an odd size 15 meg.
Anyway, so don't know a whole lot more about it, but it'd be interesting to take a look at the pictures again, even if you're not specifically interested in trying to get it. It right now is being, it's bid up to $305 now. Shipping is, to me, $115, but so it's an investment, but unusual.
I noticed on the back there, the picture shows a covered port for something called ArcNet. Do you guys know what that is?
No.
Right next to parallel printer.
ArcNet. Yeah, ArcNet.
Yeah, interesting. Whatever it is, seems not to be installed.
Yes.
But
and it's plugged up. Yeah, interesting.
Upgrade.
Yeah, well, here, and this listing is also an example of one of the downsides to eBay's new global shipping program. So it makes it easier for sellers, especially if you're in the U.S., you want to offer things around the world, you can just sign up and say, I'm using the global shipping program. So when it sells, it calculates the all the postage for you. It pre-does duty and taxes for the person receiving it. You simply slap the label on and everything arrives. Sounds great, isn't. Because the problem is, it just assumes that everything in the world should have duty on it all the time. Now, this is a computer. It's a vintage computer. And there would be no duty in Canada for this product. You can bring it over the border. You should pay nothing. But this is going to charge duty just because they say, we're calling it electronics and too bad for you. So right now, it's got, for me, $134 shipping and $46 duty based on the current bid. If you end up buying this thing for $1,000, then you'll end up paying, you know, $150 extra duty just because they feel like charging you for it. So it's a thing to look out for international shippers, is watch out for the global shipping program. It can burn you sometimes in ways that you wouldn't otherwise have been.
Yeah, I've sold a couple things on eBay, and I can't make up my mind about the global shipping program, because it's sort of easy, but it really makes me kind of nervous, because the thing is that if you're sending something to someone that's not in the U.S., what you do is you send it to a U.S. address, and they sort of consolidate somehow and ship it on. But, you know, I can pack it so it's nice when it gets to Kentucky or wherever. But beyond that, you know, I don't know, but yet when it gets to Brazil or wherever it's going, it may well, actually Brazil's not, I think, an option for the global shipping program. But if it's broken at that point, you know, I don't know what happened. You know, I don't know what to do. I sort of feel like I would rather have end-to-end responsibility, at least.
Or in my case, like I'll use a transshipper. Like I have an address in the States you can send it to, and they won't repack it. So they'll just pack around your packing and send it on. And so there's things a buyer could do. But at the same time, it's nice that people make things available. A lot of American sellers simply just say, it's too much of a hassle, I'm not shipping outside of the States. So happy that things are available at all.
Right.
But it's a bit of a downside that you can be really burned on shipping and customs fees with that program.
Yeah. Let's see.
So what's your other choice?
My other choice. Oh, yes. I don't know, actually. I mean, I do know, but Earl might know more about this sort of thing. But
he's not here, so screw him.
Yes. All right. Well,
Earl probably knows what ArcNet is also.
Yes.
Earl, where are you?
He's frozen.
So what I, but the thing, what it is it's called the Vic Relay. It is a little plug-in board that you can, that it will work on the Vic 20, I think also in the Commodore 64. And it provides basically a bunch of little relay switches that you can use to control electronic things outside of your computer. So if you want to set this up to like turn lights on and off, or, you know, just do things in the actual world with your Vic 20, this is the way to do it. It's the Dorktronic Vic Relay Interface. So
okay, that's actually all pretty awesome.
It is. It's a newly produced thing. But it looks very nice, and you can't beat the name. And so it's not trivially cheap. It's $45 buy it now. But it looks well made, and it's a unique thing. I like it.
Pretty cool.
I love it. I was always fascinated by things like X10 and ways to control lamps from computers and robotic arms from computers and what have you. So something like this, it's all assembled and looks pretty straightforward. That's pretty nice. That's a pretty sweet thing. It's for the 64, so I'm out. But,
well, the VIC-20, maybe you can, though. Even if you hate the 64,
sure, yeah,
the VIC-20's
okay,
right?
I want the 64 stupid cousin. Yeah, I'm going to go that way instead, right. That's going
to
so
get better. The extra memory card that you switch down to, like,
yeah, right.
Whatever it is, 16K.
Exactly. But this is actually a pretty sweet-looking product, I will admit. Nice.
Does this plug into the cartridge port or what?
No, I think it looks... it probably says in there, but it looks like it's plugging into the IEEE...
Oh, it says the standard user port, whatever that is.
Oh, a user port, okay.
What is that? Is that for... I don't know what that's for on these things.
It is, well, it is it's an expansion port, like a slot in a,
okay.
I'm not sure if it's daisy chainable. From what I understand, it's actually very close to the CPU. I mean, you can do quite a lot on the user port. And that's actually all I had stuck in the show notes for eBay. I'm sure there, new interesting things have been listed since, but you'll hear all about them a week after they've closed next time. That's all I had. We can move on to the closing discussions. Carrington, you've written something in the show notes, which is a good thing to discuss.
It is. So my brain got turned into pudding and was exploded over and over recently when reading a 4AM hack, because everyone should read those. And at the bottom, it just mentioned that something had recently been pointed out or showed up in something called POC or GTFO. Stands for Proof of Concept or GTFO.
Right.
So I'm like, well, what is this? What is this? I said, the last thing I said while I still had a brain, because I did a search for it. Find out it's a thing that's been going on for a while. Episode or issue number, well, number 11, but issue 10, counting from zero, is out. And it is unreal. So if you're interested in anything awesome, it's all here. So it's this PDF journal, and it's got hacking things and exploit stuff and brilliance and beautifulness. And I don't understand how I never even knew this existed. And my response was simply, what, over and over. And that's all I've said since. So the latest version does have a little bit about Apple II copy protections. There is brilliance here, there is math here, there is creativity, there's genius, there are micro dots embedded,
yeah.
Some of these are... It is unbelievable in a wonderful, old-school, hacky way. It is crazy, it has changed my life, everybody should be reading this.
Yeah.
I was scrolling...
I don't know if I've built it up enough, but holy
I was scrolling
crap.
Through one of these now, and it looks amazing.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah.
It is amazing. It will blow your mind and teach you things and just mostly teach you that other people out there are way smarter than you. That's my takeaway from this.
Right.
It's crazy and just deals with hacking in like the traditional sense. And it's wonderful, and it's wonderfully put together, and it has embedded little secrets, and it's all just great. Holy cow, it's great. So run, don't walk. You should be reading this instead of doing anything else, including listening to our podcast.
Beautiful.
So the article that I focused in on when I heard about this was a chapter of this that is called A Brief Description of Some Popular Copy Protection Techniques on the Apple II Platform. And this is Peter Ferry, also goes by Cucumba, who wrote this. 4AM declined, he says in there. But it is, the article itself is really super interesting. It's very detailed about the different kinds of copy protection that people have done on the Apple II, and he gives examples of different places that used it And it's an accessible article. You don't have to necessarily be a complete genius to read it, but it covers a lot.
The ads are amazing.
Yeah.
They're embedded with like old school ads. It's very much like it's in the style of an old zine. Mm-hmm. And it's great. Holy cow, it's great. The ads. Just for the ads alone, you should read it.
I haven't tried this, but from what I understand, this file that you probably we're all looking at now on our screens, it's a PDF, except that if you open it with like a zip program, it's a zip file.
It's like executable.
Yeah. I mean, like it's some weird hybrid file that you can open in like several different, like view from several different perspectives.
Of course you can.
Very cool.
Because why wouldn't you be able to? Yeah, it's just, it's lovely. It's truly, it just filled my heart with joy. So I thought we have to mention it. I just want to mention it and link to it so more people can have that brain explodey moment.
Very nice.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I will say thanks with the last piece of my brain.
Yep, say goodbye. Oh, it's so lovely. Just, I'm hooked, hooked, hooked.
So, Jack, how about you? Any closing thoughts?
No, not really. Actually, the one closing thought I've had is that we're in January now, and you know, now and then you hear people talking about in January, oh, do you have any New Year's resolutions? And I usually say that I don't. And I remember a year ago we talked about it, and my New Year's resolution was actually I was going to try and get better at 6502 assembly. And a year has gone by, and I can say that I have failed.
Is that why you linked this time to the easier way to do assembly?
Yeah, this may be an easier way for me to actually get some coding done without all the irritation.
Keep lowering that bar a few years from now. You'd be like, here's a new one, the one-letter assembly program.
Oh, well.
That's it.
Well,
I join you in that goal, though. I have done little bits of assembly, but I've never done a big project. Like, here's a full end-to-end video game.
Right.
In assembly, and that remains one of my goals.
I think it's a worthwhile goal. I think that anyone who does programming should learn some assembly, because even if, you know, for most of what programmers are doing, it doesn't make sense to use assembly today for anything modern, but I think it's very useful to understand what is underlying the things that we're doing. You know, it's easy to get caught up in a high-level language, like, you're working in Java or Python or Swift or whatever, and you're so far removed from the machine that I think just learning assembly is a great eye-opener for any developer.
Yeah. See, I think it's okay in a modern context to be completely removed from the machine. I'm okay with that. My problem is it feels like cheating, because this was a goal I had basically 30 years ago.
Right.
And to say now, oh, well, it's no longer really needed, just seems like a cop-out that I'm just giving myself an excuse to not consider it a failure. But it is a failure. That if I don't have this game put out, it's totally a failure. So I should hold myself to a higher standard.
I agree.
Yes, you should. Yeah, yeah.
Perhaps, Carrington, we can try and hold each other to a higher standard. We can check in now and then.
Or just hold each other.
That too. But apart from that, hold each other and to a higher standard.
Right, but I should... maybe this year, but the reality is it is a failure if I don't at some point stand up at Kansas Fest and say, here's a game... It's fully written in assembler, and it's out there. And if I don't do that, then, I mean, that's really the standard to which I should be holding this. I release a game to the public, fully written in assembler. Like, come on. It's not that hard. Like, it's laziness holding me back, really.
You can do it.
Sure, anybody
can believe
in
you.
Absolutely. It's totally doable. The little bits of assembler I know, it's not more difficult than any other kind of program.
No, I mean...
It's just a little bit more finicky, and I'm just super lazy.
I have a good start at a Flappy Bird game for the Atari VCS. The game is not complete. I don't have a menu screen or a start screen or like scores, but like the actual gameplay, I got it mostly working just by like spending a few hours poking around at stuff and seeing how the hardware worked. So it's definitely doable for anybody who's done some programming. Just take some time and thinking.
What's the name of that?
I just called it Flippy Bit. It's not out anywhere.
I like the name very much.
I first made an iOS app called Flippy Bit. And it was sort of Atari style. And I was like, wait a minute, I should actually do this for the Atari.
Is the bit that goes up and down like the bit from Tron?
No, it's just...
When you go up, it's a 1, and when you go down, it's a 0
Unfortunately, it's just a square.
Well, so it's the bit from Tron in the same way that like an inventor, you're like some guy walking around a maze, right?
Yes. It's the same character graphics as the adventure guy.
Excellent.
Actually, speaking of... since we're here in the closing thoughts and done with the news, mentioning all this assembler stuff, Quinn Dunkey had a article just like today, I think, on her Blondie Hack site about basically she's working on kind of going through the boot process, the very early boot process in the Apple IIc Plus, in order to set the default speed to slow instead of fast.
And it turns out it's crazily convoluted.
Yeah, it's quite an interesting adventure, but. This is an example of like knowing 6502 inside and out. I mean, and also all the sort of machine specific stuff about how bank switching works and all that stuff. It's I would like to think I could do this, but I'm not sure that I could, and I really don't know that I would have the patience. This is really quite amazing. What she's done, and that she actually managed to, that she didn't give up, and it works at the end.
It would have beaten me. The tenacity that it took for her to stick with this is, because there's so many, I reading it through, I'm like, yeah, I'd be out. No, I would have said, come on.
Yep. Here, I'm just, out. Here,
yeah,
I'm
totally.
Out also. Yeah.
There's a bunch of places I just would have been out. It's quite bonkers, so quite an achievement.
Yeah. Yeah, really. But yeah, definitely very interesting. I'm glad that she's done it, and I'm also the write-up is really quite thorough.
Mm-hmm. So all hers are. The Blondie Hack site is it's real. She doesn't just say, "Oh, I did a thing." Like, it's always so much detail in such an interesting way. Like, it's a great resource.
Yeah. Cool. So thanks, Quinn, for doing that. Mm-hmm. As far as what I have, I don't know. I actually put a bunch of stuff. So at a certain point, I thought, all right, my office is a mess. It's got like piles of equipment and stuff everywhere, and a lot of these piles have been sitting there mostly in that same shape with the same stratification for a year and a half. So I decided, all right, I'm going to put everything in boxes so that at least it's, you know, not gathering extra dust.
At least you don't see it.
Yeah. Right.
A problem hidden is a problem solved.
Exactly. So now I have a couple of nice towers of boxes, but it does look a little bit more like a human occupies this office.
So you have a hinge.
I'm getting, yeah, soon I will have a hinge.
Everybody likes a hinge.
Keyboards are actually pretty good for bridging between the columns of a hinge. Excellent.
Nice.
Okay, I guess that anyone else have any other thoughts?
I'm out.
Okay.
I'm out. Nothing more for me.
I am also out, and so...
I did add for the show links, I added the link to, I have Flippy Bit on GitHub.
Oh, fantastic. Look at that. Nice.
Poke around. There it is.
Excellent.
Poke around with Flippy Bit.
Yep. Okay, so now everybody out?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. So that will be it for the show then. You can find the show notes for this and all the RCR shows at rcrpodcast.com. You can discuss us in the forums at vintage-computer.com/bcforum. You can follow RCR on Twitter at RCR Podcast. You can join our Facebook group. I think you can search, but it's also at facebook.com/groups/RCR Podcast. You can send us feedback at feedback@rcrpodcast.com. And we are a member of the Throwback Network at throwbacknetwork.net, who also have a Facebook page that we will link to. If you get a chance, prepare to review of us on iTunes. That'll help people find the show. Many stars are welcome.
All the stars.
Yeah. And I guess that's it. So until next time.
Retro Compute!
Please put in the possible commercial. Please.
That's a pretty good idea.